James Joyce's Ulysses stands as perhaps the most celebrated yet unread novel of the 20th century. When Time magazine compiled its list of the 100 greatest novels, Ulysses claimed the top spot, with the judges declaring it had transformed the novel form forever. Yet for many, this modernist masterpiece remains an intimidating literary Everest. Barack Obama has cited it as the book that most shaped him as a young man, while rock legend Patti Smith described it as the book that taught me what writing could be. Joyce's novel, published in 1922 after years of censorship battles, follows a single day in Dublin through the wanderings of two men, creating what many consider the most profound exploration of human consciousness ever committed to paper. Joyce's Dublin is a city haunted by absences, a landscape where the dead hold as much presence as the living. Throughout Ulysses, characters are defined not by what they are, but by what they've lost, creating a complex tapestry of memory and longing. Stephen Dedalus walks the streets shadowed by his dead mother, whose ghost appears repeatedly in his thoughts, demanding penance for his refusal of her dying wish to pray. Her presence manifests in everyday moments, in the crack of a matchstick, in the scent of wax and rosewood, in the very air of his morning walks along Sandymount Strand. Leopold Bloom, the novel's central figure, moves through his day carrying twin specters, his father, who committed suicide by poisoning in a Dublin hotel, and his infant son Rudy, who died 11 days after birth. These ghosts aren't mere background elements, but active forces shaping the characters' identities and actions, influencing everything from their daily routines to their deepest thoughts. Names themselves become unstable entities in Joyce's universe, shifting and transforming like shadows on a wall. Leopold appears as Poldy to his wife Molly, herself transformed from Marion, while his daughter Millie affectionately calls him Papley. The evolution of Bloom's family name carries particular weight. His father changed from the Hungarian Virag to the English Bloom, seeking social acceptance in Victorian Dublin, yet Leopold ironically uses Henry Flower as his pseudonym in secret correspondence with Martha Clifford. This naming play connects to the epic tradition that establishes identity through genealogies, yet Joyce refuses anything larger than life. His characters remain relational and reduced rather than monolithic. Bloom becomes a modernist self as textual process, simultaneously too much and too little, no man and every man, echoing both Odysseus and the common man. The novel's treatment of identity challenges traditional notions of selfhood through a series of deliberate destabilizations. When a mysterious man in a Macintosh appears at Patty Dignam's funeral, he's transformed into Macintosh in the newspaper report, identity reduced to a misunderstood garment. This playful approach to naming reveals Joyce's deeper concern with how language both creates and manipulates identity. The newspaper office episode further emphasizes this theme, as headlines fragment and reconstruct meaning, while the Circe episode's hallucinations completely dissolve stable identities. Even Dublin itself becomes a character whose identity shifts and changes, its streets and buildings taking on different meanings depending on who observes them and when. This makes Ulysses not just a story about particular characters, but about the very nature of selfhood in the modern world, where identity is never fixed, but constantly in flux, shaped by memory, loss, and the endless transformations of language. Ulysses unfolds entirely on June 16, 1904, now celebrated worldwide as Bloom's Day, following three principal characters through the streets of Dublin. Stephen Dedalus, the young intellectual we first met in Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, begins his day teaching history at a boys' school while nursing a hangover and mourning his mother. Leopold Bloom, a middle-aged Jewish advertising canvasser, prepares breakfast for his wife Molly before attending a funeral and wandering through Dublin, all while knowing his wife will be having an affair with Blazes Boylan that afternoon. Molly Bloom remains in bed for most of the novel, her thoughts finally revealed in the famous unpunctuated monologue that closes the book. The novel's structure deliberately parallels Homer's Odyssey, with Bloom as a modern Odysseus, Ulysses, Stephen as Telemachus, and Molly as Penelope. Each of the novel's 18 episodes corresponds to an adventure from Homer's epic, though Joyce transforms these heroic encounters into mundane Dublin experiences. The Cyclops becomes a one-eyed Irish nationalist in a pub, the Sirens are barmaids whose songs entice Bloom, and Circe transforms into the madam of a nighttown brothel where hallucinations reveal characters' deepest fears and desires. What makes Joyce's approach revolutionary is how he elevates ordinary life to epic significance. Bloom's journey to buy a kidney for breakfast, his visit to a public bath, his awkward conversation with a young woman on the beach all received the same weight and significance as Odysseus's legendary adventures. Through this parallel, Joyce suggests that the heroism of modern life lies not in grand exploits, but in enduring the everyday with compassion and curiosity. Bloom's kindness, his scientific mindset, and his tolerance make him heroic in a world of prejudice and nationalism. Joyce's most revolutionary contribution to literature was his development of stream-of-consciousness technique, allowing readers unprecedented access to characters' inner thoughts. While earlier novelists had experimented with interior monologue, none had achieved the depth and authenticity of Joyce's approach. In Ulysses, thoughts flow naturally, often illogically, filled with half-formed ideas, misremembered quotations, and sudden associations that mirror actual human cognition. When Leopold Bloom walks through Dublin, his thoughts wander from advertising slogans to memories of his father to fantasies about distant lands, all triggered by what he sees around him. Watching a young woman on the beach prompts a complex internal response mixing desire, shame, memory, and scientific curiosity. When he attends Paddy Dignam's funeral, his thoughts about death intermingle with mundane observations about the other mourners' appearances and behavior. This technique creates an extraordinary intimacy between reader and character. We don't just observe Bloom, we inhabit his consciousness, experiencing Dublin through his senses and thoughts. The technique reaches its apex in Molly Bloom's famous final monologue, where her unpunctuated thoughts flow across nearly 50 pages as she lies in bed remembering her past and contemplating her marriage. This revolutionary approach influenced generations of writers, from Virginia Woolf to William Faulkner to contemporary novelists like Ian McEwan. What makes Joyce's stream of consciousness so powerful is its absolute authenticity. Unlike the neat, articulate interior monologues of earlier fiction, Joyce's characters think in fragments, with grammatical errors, misunderstandings, and the constant intrusion of bodily sensations. Stephen's thoughts are filled with literary allusions and philosophical musings, while Bloom's mind works through practical problems and scientific curiosities. Each character's consciousness is distinctly their own, revealing Joyce's extraordinary psychological insight. Perhaps the most daring aspect of Ulysses is Joyce's refusal to settle on a single narrative style. Each episode employs a different technique, often parodying or paying homage to various literary traditions. This stylistic experimentation transforms the novel into what critic Hugh Kenner called a laboratory of narrative techniques, where Joyce systematically tests the limits of what language and literature can achieve. The novel begins with relatively straightforward narration in the Telemachus episode, employing a modernist third-person perspective that echoes writers like Flaubert. However, this familiar ground quickly gives way to more experimental territory. Aeolus, set in a newspaper office, fragments into headlines and journalistic prose, mimicking both the physical environment of the printing press and the choppy, attention-grabbing style of yellow journalism. The Wandering Rocks episode presents 19 different perspectives on a single hour in Dublin, with precise timestamps creating a complex choreography of intersecting characters and events. Sirens represents one of Joyce's most ambitious formal experiments, structuring itself like a musical fugue. The episode opens with an overture of seemingly nonsensical sound fragments that later develop into full sentences, incorporating over 60 different musical terms and techniques. The prose itself becomes increasingly lyrical and rhythmic, with words chosen as much for their sonic qualities as their meaning. Lines like "bronze by gold, heard the hoof irons, steely ringing," demonstrate how Joyce transforms ordinary Dublin scenes into musical compositions. Cyclops alternates between the earthy first-person narration of an unnamed bar patron and extravagantly overblown parodies of Irish mythological tales. These parodies extend to legal jargon, scientific writing, and epic poetry, creating a satirical commentary on Irish nationalism and bombastic rhetoric. Most famously, Oxen of the Sun, set in a maternity hospital, traces the development of English prose from Anglo-Saxon fragments through medieval chronicles, Renaissance prose, and Victorian sentimentality, ending in contemporary slang, paralleling the gestation of a child. Joyce mimics dozens of distinct literary styles, from Malory to Dickens, creating a virtual anthology of English prose. This stylistic virtuosity serves multiple purposes beyond mere technical display. It demonstrates Joyce's encyclopedic knowledge of literary tradition while simultaneously undermining the authority of any single narrative voice. It creates a sense that language itself is the true protagonist of Ulysses, constantly evolving, playful, and ultimately unreliable. The shifting styles also reflect the novel's theme of transformation and its refusal to present a single, stable reality. Joyce's stylistic experiments reach their culmination in the Circe episode, where the narrative takes the form of a surreal play script extending over 170 pages. As Bloom and Stephen wander through Dublin's red light district, their repressed thoughts and desires materialize as hallucinations. Bloom is put on trial, transformed into a woman, and witnesses the appearance of his dead son. This psychodramatic technique allows Joyce to externalize his character's inner lives in ways conventional narrative could never achieve, while also incorporating elements from previous episodes in distorted, dreamlike forms. The episode's dramatic form enables rapid shifts between reality and fantasy, past and present, creating a kaleidoscopic vision of the character's psychological states. While Ulysses is often celebrated for its formal innovations, it's equally significant as a political novel exploring Ireland's colonial relationship with Britain. Set in 1904, 18 years before Irish independence, the novel portrays a Dublin whose citizens live under constant surveillance, their identities shaped by imperial power. The Cyclops episode most explicitly addresses Irish nationalism through the figure of the citizen, a one-eyed xenophobic nationalist who attacks Bloom for his Jewish heritage. When Bloom attempts to define nation as the same people living in the same place, and then awkwardly adds, or also living in different places, he inadvertently exposes the contradictions in nationalist ideology. His final declaration that Christ was a Jew brilliantly turns the tables on his persecutors, demonstrating how nationalist rhetoric uses terms like Jew to paper over the fissures between an imagined organic community and reality. Joyce's portrayal of women, particularly Molly Bloom, reveals another dimension of colonial politics. As critic Enda Duffy argues, Molly represents the most abject subaltern subject in the novel, a woman in the male-dominated colonial system. Though confined to her Echo Street house while Bloom freely traverses the city, Molly has been successfully interpolated as an ideal colonial subject who admires British military pageantry and eagerly consumes colonial commodities. Yet Molly's unpunctuated monologue reveals a sophisticated understanding of information control and power. She recounts numerous scenarios where men function as tiresome questioners, from Bloom's sexual interrogations to formal questioning by authority figures like priests and doctors. Her response is the carnival discourse of the subaltern, appearing innocent while subverting the oppressor's words through humor and internal commentary. The controversial yes that concludes the novel represents this ambivalence. In colonial contexts, the only word the native is expected to utter is acquiescence. Yet Molly transforms her wedding yes from submission into an assertion of equality by recounting how she asked him with my eyes to ask again. Her final yes remains ambiguous, either the acquiescence of a deeply interpellated colonial subject or a marker of new equality between freed subjects. Joy scandalized early 20th century readers by refusing to idealize the human body, creating what would become one of literature's most controversial and groundbreaking portrayals of physical existence. Unlike previous literature that either ignored bodily functions or treated them with euphemistic distance, Ulysses presents characters who eat, defecate, menstruate, masturbate, and experience flatulence with unflinching realism. This raw portrayal of physical reality was largely responsible for the novel's censorship until 1934, with several countries banning the book outright and copies being burned by customs officials. The novel's corporeal journey begins with Stephen's friend Buck Mulligan performing his morning ritual of shaving, described in almost ceremonial detail, mixing the sacred and profane. Soon after, we follow Leopold Bloom to the outhouse where he reads newspaper advertisements while defecating, an episode that sets the tone for the novel's merger of the mundane and the philosophical. Throughout the day, Bloom's bodily functions punctuate his consciousness. He salivates at the smell of kidneys, urinates in his garden, and experiences digestive discomfort. Later, he masturbates on Sandy Mount Strand while watching Gertie McDowell, and the Nausicaa episode concludes with his observation, "Lord, I am wet." This focus on bodily fluids creates what critic Clara McLean calls a tension between containment and release. Semen is both the source of life and something that must be expelled, reflecting larger themes of creation and waste. Joyce's treatment of the body isn't merely provocative, but philosophically significant, representing a direct challenge to Cartesian dualism. By refusing to separate mind and body, he challenges Western philosophical traditions that privilege consciousness over corporality. Thoughts in Ulysses are never purely intellectual, but always embodied, influenced by hunger, desire, discomfort, and pleasure. When Bloom contemplates the vastness of the cosmos, his philosophical musings are interrupted by digestive rumblings from the kidney he ate for breakfast. Similarly, Stephen's sophisticated literary allusions are frequently undercut by his awareness of his unwashed body and dirty clothes. This embodied consciousness reaches its apex in Molly's final monologue, where physical sensations and memories intertwine inseparably in a stream of consciousness that pulses with bodily awareness. Her recollections of sexual encounters are intensely physical, focusing on bodily sensations rather than romantic emotions, from the taste of seed cake passed from mouth to mouth to the sensations of menstruation. Yet these physical experiences connect to her deeper reflections on life, death, and meaning, suggesting that our embodied experiences are not separate from our intellectual and spiritual lives, but fundamental to them. The body in Ulysses becomes not just a vessel for consciousness, but the very medium through which we experience and understand the world. The novel's treatment of the body also extends to illness and mortality. Bloom's thoughts frequently return to his father's suicide and his infant son's death, while the maternity hospital episode in Oxen of the Sun connects bodily functions to both creation and destruction. Through these various bodily manifestations, Joyce presents a complete vision of human existence that refuses to privilege the spiritual over the physical, instead showing how they are inextricably intertwined. The Circe episode, set in Dublin's red light district known as Nighttown, represents Joyce's most sustained exploration of the uncanny, what Freud described as that class of the frightening which leads back to what is known of old and long familiar. As Bloom and Stephen wander through this district, they encounter a series of hallucinations that materialize their repressed desires and fears. Critic Jeffrey Weinstock argues that these apparitions function as deconstructive gestures that reverse hierarchical binaries like presence-absence and life-death. Bloom encounters his dead grandfather Virag, sees Gertie McDowell transformed into a ruined maiden-turned-whore, witnesses Bella Cohen's transformation into the masculine Bello, and even confronts his own feminized, self-alienated other. These uncanny figures aren't merely psychological projections, but represent the return of what has been repressed in Dublin's colonial society. The episode's treatment of gender is particularly significant. When Bloom bends to tie Bello's bootlace, his submissive posture instantly genders him female through what Michael McDonald calls a synecdoche that is not substitution but identity itself. In this realm, gender positions become essentially meaningless, and the episode's frenzied instability of signification follows not merely from confused sexual identities, but from the threat posed to linguistic stability by interchangeability itself. McDonald argues that Joyce's portrayal of Nighttown's uncanniness reveals capitalism's constitutive perversity. When Bloom appears as a charming soubrette with dauby cheeks and justifies trying on Molly's clothes as motivated by purist thrift rather than perversion, this rationalization represents capitalism's core dynamic, the reduction of desire's inherent excess to utilitarian logic. Joyce thus creates a crucial link between Freudian and Marxian notions of the unheimlich, showing how capitalism's logic of commodity fetishism produces the very uncanniness experienced in the episode. At the heart of Ulysses lies a profound meditation on artistic creation. Through Stephen Dedalus, Joyce explores the young artist's struggle to find his authentic voice amid the overwhelming influence of literary forebears. In the Proteus episode, Stephen contemplates his literary ancestors, Irish writers who achieved immortality through their work, while questioning what he must do to join their ranks. Stephen considers various Protean forms represented by different Irish literary figures, Columbanus, Swift, Berkeley, Wilde, as well as contemporaries like A.E., Yeats, and Hyde. He contrasts these successful writers with Kevin Egan, the forgotten nationalist exile in Paris who merely prints others' words rather than creating his own legacy. Stephen fears becoming like Egan, a failed artist producing nothing original. The question haunting Stephen is whether he can transcend his influences to achieve literary immortality, or whether he will remain a conglomerate of other people's thoughts. Michael Murphy argues that Stephen seeks not a father figure, but fatherhood in the artistic sense. How to father a work of art? The essay distinguishes between begetting, natural reproduction, and making, artistic creation. Unlike biological children who are begotten, art must be made through craft and workmanship. Joyce himself resolves this artistic dilemma through the novel's form. Unlike Stephen, who remains paralyzed by his influences, Joyce embraces literary tradition while transforming it into something radically new. In the Oxen of the Sun episode, Joyce treats earlier literary passages as a collective fund of circulating capital available to all linguistic workers. The episode operates within what Mark Osteen calls a paradoxical intertextual economy, where originality and authority emerge from the proliferation of plagiarism. By foregrounding the relationship between authorship and reading, Joyce suggests readers are co-creators, undermining the ideology of plagiarism while seeming to canonize the fathers of English prose. Joyce's labor thus parallels Mina Purefoy's childbirth in the episode, valorizing a reproductive economy that challenges patriarchal ideology while creating something genuinely new. Ulysses concludes with perhaps the most famous passage in modernist literature, Molly Bloom's unpunctuated interior monologue spanning the final 50 pages. This revolutionary conclusion gives the final word to a woman after a predominantly male-centered narrative, fundamentally questioning the possibility of envisioning community beyond masculinist fellowship. Molly's monologue has been widely misinterpreted as representing pure feminine fluidity. Michael Stonier challenges this common feminist reading that Molly's language exemplifies écriture féminine, a fluid feminine discourse that subverts phallocentric language. Drawing on Derek Attridge's analysis, he argues that Molly's language is relatively conventional and not particularly transgressive. Her apparent ambiguities are only ambiguous to readers, not to Molly herself. In fact, Stevens and Leopold's interior monologues infringe grammatical conventions far more radically than Molly's, whose sentences are, on the whole, fairly short. The impression of unstoppable flow comes from the presentation on the page, the absence of punctuation and capitalization, rather than from any inherently feminine qualities. The monologue culminates in Molly's famous yes as she recalls accepting Leopold's marriage proposal on Howth Head. This affirmation has been variously interpreted as representing unconditional acceptance, sexual openness, or the cyclical nature of existence. What makes the ending so powerful is its ambiguity. The yes simultaneously looks backward to the beginning of Molly and Leopold's relationship and forward to possible reconciliation. Through this conclusion, Joyce refuses the closure expected in traditional narratives. Instead of resolving the novel's conflicts, the ending opens outward into possibility. Molly's final thoughts, "And yes, I said yes, I will, yes," suggest not finality, but continuation, not resolution, but process. This refusal of closure perfectly embodies Joyce's modernist vision, where meaning emerges not from definitive answers, but from the ongoing interplay of language, consciousness, and embodied experience.